Hello, and welcome to National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. We, this month, have a themed issue of National Geographic. It's about women, a century of change. And we have begun our reading of the issue with a long essay by Michelle Norris. We began it last week, and let's continue it this week. She's tracing the women's movement in general and some of her own personal experiences with it. In a seismic development, the U.S. women's national soccer team dominated the World Cup with such force, consistency, and chutzpah that it outperformed the U.S. men's team in victories, viewership, and pop culture status. When you mention American soccer today, the women are the ones who symbolize the sport. But we still live in a time when those megastars are fighting in court to ensure they are paid the same as men. Actually, it's not even about equal pay for equal work. It's equal pay for demonstrably more successful work. These are women who strut their success, reveling in their triumphs on the field, and becoming role models for women seeking to challenge the basis for their second-class status. For centuries, women have been viewed as the weaker, more vulnerable gender. They have been rendered inferior, not necessarily with their consent, but with considerable help from social constructs and scientific research. British journalist Angela Saini documents how science has long defined and confined women in her book, Inferior: How Science Got Women Wrong and the New Research That's Rewriting the Story. And there's an essay in this issue regarding that. Saini argues that male scientists used their studies and influence to amplify their own attitudes about gender and racial inequality. The results of their work hardened sexism into something that couldn't even be challenged. And to make sure that women didn't have the chance to prove the science wrong, they were denied the ability to flex their intellect or fully develop their talents. Much of the research that tagged women as the weaker sex was flawed or biased. A body of work counters that early science, showing that women possess intellectual capabilities equal to their male counterparts. While men have greater physical strength and height and weight advantage, studies show that women have a distinct edge when it comes to resilience and long-term survival. So, why do men hold more power than women today? Why does gender inequality persist? The explanation is so often, it's just the way it's always been. That's simply not good enough, and that justification should crumble in the face of evidence showing that places with policies hampering or oppressing women lose ground economically. Take Asia as an example. Slightly more than half of the region's women work, and those women are paid less than men. Gender norms, barriers to education, and entrenched cultural forces could maintain that status quo, but analysts warn that countries impeding the advancement of women will pay a steep price. The consulting firm McKinsey & Company estimates that the regional economy would gain as much as $4.5 trillion in annual GDP by 2025 if women were no longer sidelined in the Asian workforce. Every country on the planet should take notice. Those T-shirts and posters that read, "The future is female," should warn instead, "The future better be female." But the obstacles to power are deeply ingrained and aren't easily overcome. You can write laws telling people what they can and cannot do, but you cannot legislate their feelings about themselves or others. We are still ambivalent about women and power. Studies suggest that women are more apt to be deemed unlikable or untrustworthy if they are perceived to be powerful, brash, or openly ambitious, traits that, by the way, are seen as management material in men. New York University professor Madeline E. Heilman conducted a series of studies to investigate the reaction to successful women in jobs traditionally held by men. In one experiment, she asked undergraduates to review nearly identical profiles for employees holding the position of assistant vice president for sales in an aircraft company. One of the employees was named James. The other was named Andrea. They were in the top 5% in employee performance reviews, and described as stellar performers or rising stars. Their profiles provided no background on their personality or character. The students rated Andrea as more disagreeable and uncivil than James, who got more glowing responses. That means the well-worn gender tropes don't just describe how men and women allegedly behave, Heilman found. They also set a template for what behavior is suitable, and that behavior is directly related to the attributes that are positively valued for each sex. Women who are kind, caring, and gentle are valued and rewarded socially. Women who are ambitious, strategic, or direct, not so much. As a society, we demonstrate a degree of trepidation and surprise about women taking the reins of power, because it's still a novel concept. Women who become police chiefs and ship captains and construction supervisors are not just hailed as mavericks. They are also practically portrayed as unicorns. The greatest barrier that many women have to overcome is experience. Again, studies find that men often are hired for potential, while women with the same experience are deemed unqualified or underqualified. Our collective cultural narrative contributes to this bias. The phrase women's work is limiting and stereotypical, attached to softer domestic tasks thought to be the province of women: cooking, cleaning, tending, gardening. But historian and activist Lisa Unger Baskin has been exploring women's work going back 7 centuries, and she has found quite a different story. Women have been holding up half the sky while toiling in jobs considered men's work. It is so important for our girls and our women, too, to see what they can do and be, so it is not just in their imaginations, Unger Baskin told me recently. And it is so important for men, for us all, really, to see female accomplishment, because over centuries humans have been conditioned to see women as the weaker, less capable sex, when all around us there is evidence showing that simply is not true. Unger Baskin has spent a lifetime trying to add to that evidence file, amassing an astounding collection documenting women's work through photographs, books, trade cards, artifacts, personal letters, and ephemera. She believes her collection, housed at the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture at Duke University, is the world's largest record of women in work and professional enterprise. Women have worked and succeeded in occupations long seen as the province of men, as laborers, scientists, printers, navigators, and mechanics, sometimes purposely keeping a low profile to avoid reproach, but most often invisible simply because of their gender. I think that the stories that we can glean from what I put together from my collection say something about power, something about disenfranchisement, Unger Baskin said. The assumption that women did not do things that were always male-dominated is just not true. Her collection grew out of curiosity and umbrage. She traveled to book fairs and rare book auctions, looking for signs that women were reading and getting educated and working all along. She discovered that women were allowed to inherit and run a printing press if they were widowed, because the work was so important and the expertise so rare. As a result, there were several significant women printers in colonial America. She discovered that Sarah Clarson was working as a bricklayer in England in 1831. That Madame Nora led a troop of glassblowers who traveled the United States in 1888, making whimsical sculptures, and that Margaret Bryan introduced math and astronomy into the curriculum at her girls' school in London in 1799. She discovered that Maria Gaetana Agnesi wrote a widely translated mathematics textbook in Milan in the mid-1700s, and that the German industrialist and illustrator Maria Sibylla Marion made the first observations and drawings of insect metamorphosis in natural settings. As a collector, Unger Baskin was often not taken seriously. That worked in her favor as she snapped up documents, books, personal letters, needlepoint, engraved silver, things that no one wanted or understood, often for just a dollar or two at bookshops, fairs, and flea markets. She talks about her discoveries as if the women she's rescued from anonymity are old friends. One that breaks her heart was an enslaved woman called Alcy, who lived in Virginia. Unger Baskin found her story on a fragment from an 1831 medical certificate in which a physician described a device to hold up Alcy's prolapsed uterus so she could be made useful again. His subject's humanity was of little interest, but her labor was so important that he was tasked with getting her back on her feet. Unger Baskin said this particularly devastating story shows how women through time have been considered inferior and yet essential. Enslaved and indentured women are included in the collection, along with items from Harriet Beecher Stowe, Emma Goldman, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the Bronte sisters, Virginia Woolf, and Sojourner Truth. Unger Baskin sees her collection as a rearview mirror that can guide women as they move forward, imagining a future that is attainable, but avoiding the mistakes of the past. One of those big lessons is inclusion. Aspirational women's movements of the past, reaching all the way back to the 18th century, have been led by and centered on white, educated, upper-class women. Even abolitionists fighting for the rights of the enslaved often kept those women at a distance socially. Sojourner Truth is known for rattling the conscience of the nation with her "Ain't I a Woman" speech, but there were tensions between Truth and abolitionists such as Stowe. Truth was not a Southern enslaved person. She was in the North. She was in New York State with Dutch owners, Unger Baskin said. She was self-sufficient, spoke well, dressed well, and acted too much like an equal. That pattern would repeat itself in the suffrage movement and the equal rights movement and into the second wave feminism of the 1970s. Examining women's work over centuries, not as it was portrayed in tapestries and paintings and literature, but rather as it was actually conducted, with calloused hands and financial acumen and clever strategy, is enlightening and heartbreaking. Why don't we know more about these brave women? How is it that their stories have been overlooked or erased? Most unsettling to me as I listened to Unger Baskin describe her life's work was recognizing that so many of the women had to strategically build an audience for their work without calling too much attention to themselves because they were operating well outside of their prescribed roles. Surviving as a businesswoman was a special art, but first each had to survive as a woman. My mother gave me that slip of paper because she never wanted me to accept subordinate status. I had two sisters, and the mantra in our house was, "You are not better than anyone else, but no one is better than you." It's the language of equality, and I find myself sharing it with my own children. But is it the language of power? If we want to push our daughters to compete side by side with our sons, we have to be willing to teach them to be comfortable with making someone else uncomfortable with their talent and success. We have to teach them that the discomfort is not theirs to solve. Power has its own language. Captains are powerful. Titans are powerful. Ringleaders and pace setters are powerful. Now, ask yourself, when you were reading those words, did an image of a woman pop into your head? If the answer is yes, take a bow, and let's hope that your outlook is contagious. But if not, thanks for your honesty, and let's get to work. I have always admired the writer and producer, Shonda Rhimes, for her storytelling gifts and monumental success at the production company that bears her name. For more than a decade, Shondaland churned out profitable and wildly popular TV shows featuring women, Black, Latino, Asian, and gay characters in groundbreaking roles. Rhimes now has a multi-million dollar production deal that gives her complete creative freedom. Her success as a woman of color in Hollywood is beyond impressive. But what I most admire is her unapologetic embrace of her phenomenal success. She has no hesitation describing herself as a titan, which she surely is. Power has been denied women for so long that it can often feel like a garment designed for someone else. A generation of women are challenging this U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe, tennis great Serena Williams, Susan and Anne Wojcicki, sisters who are the CEOs of YouTube and 23andMe, General Motors CEO Mary T. Barra, TV superstar Oprah Winfrey, and all the women who have inspired the Me Too movement that rose up to challenge a system that flagrantly disregarded women's rights for decades. When the stories of sexual harassment in Hollywood and then finance and other and then journalism and then everywhere exploded into a drumbeat of yes, titans dethroned for sexually abusive behavior, a small group of women began meeting in Hollywood every day to collectively demand changes that would protect and uplift women. Their effort ran parallel to the Me Too campaign to raise awareness about sexual harassment. The Hollywood group was looking to create a movement, not a moment, and they called it Time's Up. Half of the early attendees and many of the financial supporters were women of color, and as their numbers grew with each week, so did their focus. Thanks in large part to a Dear Sisters letter written on behalf of female farm workers. Those women, led by Monica Ramirez, now the president of Justice for Migrant Women, wrote to the women gathering in Hollywood to express solidarity and explain that they faced a similar plight in the employ of men who took advantage of the instability and powerlessness that come with poverty and itinerant work. The letter, which appeared in Time magazine, read in part, "We wish that we could say we're shocked to learn that this is such a pervasive problem in your industry. Sadly, we're not surprised because it's a reality we know far too well." Read aloud at a Time's Up gathering in Beverly Hills by the actress America Ferrera, the letter set off a geyser of tears, said Michelle Kidley, an early Time's Up organizer and the chief innovation officer for Creative Artists Agency. "This was just the crystallization of something that allowed us to rise above the crisis to the meta moment. Can we rise as sisters across race and class and create a new language together that allows us to celebrate our differences and truly, truly sisterhood allows us to celebrate our link?" She explained, "On a hill or in a valley, we are all in this together." Within a year, the group had raised $22 million for a legal defense fund to help women employed as hotel workers, healthcare workers, factory operators, security guards, lawyers, academics, and artists seeking equal pay, safe working conditions, and protections from sexual harassment. Rhymes was able to create the kind of workplace she always wanted, but she knows that most women don't have that luxury. In the months when the Hollywood women were meeting at least once a day, Rhymes was the one who pushed the group to think boldly, not just imagining how they could fix the system, but imagining how the system should have worked from the beginning, free of the power dynamics that instinctively conferred subordinate status to women. Even in that moment when women were taking control and seeking to foster a truly global movement, even when they were coming together in a collective roar, gender stereotypes still could have a pernicious effect, creating a kind of knee-jerk reticence. "I continue to find it really sad that people are afraid to ask to be equal," Rhymes told me. "And women seem very afraid to ask to be equal," she said, adding that she's seen it over and over, from the way women apologize and from the way women try to negotiate their contracts, from the way women stand up for themselves. Women who want to change the world, or to go as far as their talents or interests take them, sometimes have to resist or reject that little voice in their head that stokes our insecurities and suggests how we should or shouldn't behave. It's like a flashing merge carefully sign. Push hard or speak out or act up and be prepared to be seen as the angry black woman, the feisty Latina, the shrew, the shrill, the agitator, the troublemaker, the word that rhymes with witch. Rhymes said a lot of women struggled with the idea of demanding equality. "It was more about how do we make the men feel comfortable with the little pieces of pie that we're asking for," she said. "It's truly a ridiculous place to start, to ask people to give you a tiny sliver of what should already be yours. So how do you change a system that is designed to dole out less to women in terms of personal safety, respect, earnings, stature, or accolades? How do you refuse to give your consent when the system slots you into a lower shelf that says inferior? Remember that quote attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt? It turns out she probably never uttered those exact words. In response to a question about a perceived snub, however, she had this to say. A snub is the effort of a person who feels superior to make someone else feel inferior. To do so, he has to find someone who can be made to feel inferior. People invested in the status quo will always be looking for people who can be made to feel inferior. It's the wobbly floor they stand on. But in this moment, where there's so much promise and so much at stake, let's make sure that it's no longer easy to find women and girls who can be made to feel inferior. Let's make sure they know their power and their place as equals. Well, with the time remaining, let's begin the next article. Actually, let's read this article. It asks the question, what is the most important challenge that women face today? And it gives several women's answers to that question. This is Ellen Pao, a tech investor and diversity advocate. She says the most important challenge is being treated equitably, based on ability to contribute, based on skills, being accepted as equal. When she sued her Silicon Valley employer for gender discrimination, she put the tech field's treatment of women on trial. In 2015, a jury ruled against Pao, who by then led the social media site Reddit. Now she runs Project Include, a nonprofit she founded to foster inclusion and diversity in the tech world. Melinda Gates answered, there isn't a country on earth where women have achieved true equality, and the barriers they face look different in different places. But no matter where you are in the world, understanding these barriers is the first step to dismantling them. And that requires making a concerted effort to gather better data about women and their lives. We don't have reliable information about how many girls are going to school, how many women have the chance to earn an income, what their health and safety looks like, and whether they're dying preventable deaths. And without that data, we can't design effective policies or interventions to meet women's needs. Data is power. Melinda Gates, of course, co-founded the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which supports efforts to reduce inequality, poverty, and other global ills. Jane Goodall, the primatologist who did pioneering work as a National Geographic grantee, leads an institute that promotes conservation and education. She says that the most important challenge that women face today is this. In so many developing countries, women have no freedom. In poor communities, families tend to provide money to educate boys over girls. In many cultures, women have no access to family planning, have numerous children, and are solely responsible for their care. For these reasons, not only women, but children, and thus our future, will suffer. Here's Laura Bush's response. My interest in Afghanistan, specifically in the lives of Afghan women, showed me that there are serious challenges in some parts of the world for women just to live safe lives. But I also think that in many parts of the world, and certainly in the United States, it's a wonderful time for women. When George was president, I looked at the statistics of girls versus boys in the United States and really realized that boys needed some attention too. We had focused so much on girls, and girls had become more successful than many boys in school. We expected way more from boys without giving them the sort of nurturing that we did girls. So it's important that while we continue to support women at home and around the world, we pay attention to boys too. Christian Amanpour, chief international correspondent for CNN, is also a veteran war reporter, and she has covered conflicts from Bosnia and Rwanda to Iraq and Afghanistan. She said the biggest challenge that women face is to get men on our side. The most important challenge is still being considered second-class citizens. And the most important thing for us is to get men on our side, period. This has to be something that men help us with. It's not a question of just swapping who's dominant. We're not looking for female dominance. We're looking for equality and to level the playing field. And we can't do that without men's buy-in as well. We hear next from Tarana Burke. She's a Brooklyn-based activist and known as the founder of the Me Too movement. If you ask different people who are passionate about reproductive justice or economic justice, they would have different answers. Obviously, for me, sexual violence is one of the most important challenges facing women. But all of it comes under the umbrella of patriarchy and the ways that patriarchy affects women economically, physically, and professionally. Amani Ballour is a young pediatrician. She was leading a largely female staff when she ran an underground hospital caring for Syrians under siege. She said, many women are still facing tyranny and control from the men in their society. This is a big challenge, but necessary for us to change. Emma Gonzalez survived the 2018 mass shooting that killed 17 students and staff at her Florida high school. She is an activist and co-founder of the March for Our Lives movement. She answered, probably harassment and discrimination, including verbal abuse and sexual abuse in the workplace and in the home. Just all the forms of sexism that are used to demean and oppress women. And so with those words from many women who have experienced different levels of power, I'm going to leave you for the week and hope that you will return next week for more of National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford, and I thank you for listening.